Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is award-winning author of books on history, landscape, and great literature, Adam Nicholson. And we are talking about his latest book, How to Be, Life Lessons from the Early Greeks. Adam, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Now, and I mean that sincerely. I don't think I've read a philosophy book or a book about philosophy that's been so enjoyable. And one of the reasons is there is such a tangible sense of place and time that you've put into this book that these people became real to me and the time became real to me.
Well, that's fantastic to hear, because that's exactly what I had in mind, that, you know, usually, I'm not a philosopher. I write about all kinds of different things. But this is a very intriguing area of life and thought, and so I don't come at it as a philosopher. I come at it as someone who's interested in the way people are. And obviously, the way people are is deeply embedded in and shaped by where they are and how they are in their everyday lives. And so that relationship between, you know, sometimes quite high and difficult thought and the realities of life is, I think, really what the book is about. How does thought relate to actuality?
I don't think I've read a philosophy book like this where geography and the culture plays such a vivid role in the evolution of philosophy. I mean, you just really put it in its place, and by doing that, it made sense, and it was understandable.
Good. I mean, that's fantastic to hear that, because I mean, I think I did call one of the chapters in the book "Philosophy Has a Geography."
Yeah,
and you know, usually in the sort of post-Platonic world where, you know, philosophy really occupies this extraordinarily disembodied sphere and doesn't really connect with everyday life, people don't think philosophy has a geography. But this moment, this extraordinary moment of emergence of Western thought about what, 650 BC, more than 2,500 years ago, seemed to me entirely dependent on it having happened where it did.
Right.
That those cities where all the philosophers lived were in the Eastern Aegean, on what's now the western coast of Turkey, and had a good, strong relationship with all the great cultures of the Near East, the Mesopotamian, Egyptian, Phoenician cultures in what's now Lebanon. But they weren't dominated by them. And that connection, that relationship, sort of being near but not subject to the great powers of the time, I think liberated minds. You know, they're all these little cities where the philosophers lived were all merchant oligarchies. You know, no great king, no kind of domineering or dominating religious establishment. And so there was a real liberty of mind. And that moment of liberty was one of pure invention, really. Just started to invent the ways in which we still think in many ways.
I love That's the terms exciting, you use for it? The terms you use, harbor minds is a great phrase.
I mean, these were harbor cities. And so the harbor cities, they were, none of them had very kind of big hinterlands. They couldn't rely on what they produced themselves. They had to rely on their connections across the Mediterranean. Great sailing, navigating cultures, sailing right to the far west end of the Mediterranean, to the silver mines in southern Spain, up into the Black Sea, to Egypt, to the ports of the Near East. And so everything they did was really dependent not on what they were, but how they could connect. And that sort of central role of connectedness, strangely what we think of as Greece now, you know, none of this happened in
That's
what
right.
we now think of as Greece. It all happened on these little, in these little marginal cities. And that kind of, that need to be inventive, that need to connect, that need to trade, that need to understand the validity and value of the other, of your trading partner, that all emerges in the way these people think. And I call it the harbor mind because it's open, inventive, kind of hungry for the possibility of difference. You know, if you could say that is the kind of mercantile frame of mind, what can I deal in now? And I think that's what they thought too.
I want to mention for the benefit of the audience, this is also a great travel book. And boy, was I ever envious of you, because here you are traveling to...
Get on a plane. I mean, just
yeah, but you're in a ship. You're in a boat on for your own, and you're sailing to all these... Oh, my God. And I got to ask you, what was it like to stand, and you do this throughout the book, stand in these places where these great minds existed?
Well, I don't know whether I'm kind of incredibly antisocial or something, but I definitely prefer meeting the dead. The dead are just these wonderful companions in places like that. There's something about the sea, too, you know, that if you are out at sea, anyone who's gone sailing knows, it's something about the present moment just falls away, and you are on a sea that is really completely indistinguishable from what it was 2,500 years ago. And so there is a kind of very, very sort of psychologically satisfying experience of... no other real human beings. Well, my wife came with me, actually. But just these crazy Greek thinkers.
I want to just have you say a word about the Phoenicians, who you termed the proto-Greeks. As you write, they're silent. Do we know that much about what they thought and what they did? I mean, we know it's what we did, but we don't know what they thought so much, do we?
Well, no. It's one of the great, great mysteries of history that in those port cities in Tyre and Sidon and Byblos, in where the Greek name for the book comes from, they were very like early Greeks. They had no, or they might have had sort of formal constitutional monarchies, but not real monarchies, and so they were self-governing merchant oligarchies like the Greek. They had writing. The Greeks borrowed their, right, or took their writing. They were great pioneer sailors and adventurers, you know, sailing all the way to Cadiz. They had colony Carthage in North Africa, was means new city in Phoenician, and yet they left nothing. I mean, well, not nothing, but a few inscriptions. But no drama, no poetry, no philosophy, no historical chronicles. And why? Nobody quite knows. It may be that everything they wrote was on papyrus.
Huh.
And the papyrus simply rotted away. It seems very unlikely that to me, because there's a lot of papyrus that survived.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think it's one of those unanswerable oddities that the Greeks, living in exactly the same cultural conditions, really, borrowing the means of writing it down, started to write down what they were thinking. Who knows what the Phoenicians thought? Nobody actually does.
Your book starts out with the figure of Odysseus in Homer's Odyssey and also the Aeneid. Why does it start there? And what do we know about Homer? Do we know that he was actually real?
Well, the Iliad and the Odyssey exist. And
you're right.
So,
but it could have been an oral tradition, right, that could have been passed
down?
Well,
I mean, there's a very, very deep oral tradition. I wrote a book about that years ago.
Yeah.
But clearly somebody wrote down these great inherited poems. Probably those poems, you know, in an oral tradition, poems are adapted in every generation. You'd make it new, you take some from the past, and you make it new again. And so at some time then, maybe around 700 BC, somebody conceived of the Iliad, and then maybe a generation later, the Odyssey. The Odyssey is obviously later. It is kind of framed around the Iliad already existing. And the Iliad is all about the destiny to which human beings are subject. You know, you are trapped in a terrifying, God-dominated, eventually brutal world. You know, Achilles, the great kind of emblem of that, he has to die, and he knows he has to die. The Odyssey, the later poem, is about the ability to choose. It's the ability to kind of make your own way through the world. It's the to become master of your fate. And eventually, as he does, Odysseus finds his way back home and reestablishes himself as king of Ithaca. And that shift from absolute dominance of a king and a tribal chief led world to one in which you can somehow become the architect of your own fate is, I think, part of this thing we were just talking about a minute ago, of a place in which, or a kind of culture in which, you can decide for yourself. You can think, how am I to be? What should I value? What does justice consist of? And so lies absolutely at the root of this whole philosophical revolution that followed. And so Homer, what did he exist? No one knows. I mean, there's a famous thing that said, well, if Homer didn't write the Odyssey, then someone of the same name probably did.
There's a...
that's where you have to leave that one.
Well, one of the things you bring up vis-a-vis the Odyssey is that sailing, the very act of sailing, is a mental exercise. And so, again, that's a return to self. I mean, as opposed to waiting for external forces to take care of your life, you're making decisions. You're the person that's making a choice, and that's a very difficult thing.
Exactly. That is exactly right. And sailing is not only absolutely central to the way in which these cities worked and thrived. many of them were involved in trading enterprises. And at the same time, that idea that you actually are captain of your ship is formative, I think. You know, the first lyric poets who just emerge at the same time particularly in the island of Lesbos in the northern Aegean, in Sappho, the great woman poet, and others, Archilochus and Alcaeus. And these poets, for the first time, use the analogy of the ship of state, the thing that you read it every day in the paper. Even the word we have, government. Government is derived eventually from the Greek word for steersman, the man who holds the tiller of the ship. And so the idea that you are mobile and in your mobility you have within your powers to decide where to go and what to be is, I think, another of these completely shaping ideas of early Greek consciousness. We're all afloat. Yeah, go on,
please. There's a moment in this section where you yourself are holding a shard from the rim of a crater, a bowl, whose insides were decorated with constellations that was created at this time. And literally, as you write, you had Odysseus's stars in your hands.
It was an incredible thing. I went to there was a Greek colony in the far west, in the Bay of Naples, on the island of Ischia. And I knew that there was a priest there who was an amateur archaeologist priest. He's died now, who'd excavated everything underneath his church. I think the church very nearly collapsed as a result. But anyway, I managed to get in there. And in a very dusty little cupboard at the back there, the woman showing me around brought out this small shard, maybe a kind of 3 by 3 inches, something like that, of green glazed paint with scratched into it the constellation of Boötes, the herdsman. And that constellation is, oddly enough, exactly the constellation that Homer describes Odysseus sailing by when he leaves the island of Calypso to get home. And so it was one of those moments, you know, when time completely folds up.
Yep.
I think time is like a sort of umbrella that you just, all the spokes kind of collapse into nothing.
Wow.
And I was incredibly moved by that somehow here in my hand now was part of the star map by which, if not Odysseus, but every one of Odysseus's contemporaries would have sailed. I mean, that is it's a miraculous feeling now.
You're listening to WI.
Where the little shard is now, in some dusty corner of a collapsing church in Ischia.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning author of books on history, landscape, and great literature, Adam Nicholson. And we're talking about his latest book, How to Be, Life Lessons from the Early Greeks. Now comes Thales. Now,
yeah, you'll laugh at Thales.
Well, you have to, because he falls in a well.
Thales is the kind of proto-absent-minded professor.
Oh, my God. And there's a great story that is told about him. Can you tell that?
He's wandering around. He lived in Miletus, this great, powerful trading city on the Aegean. And he's wandering around at night, staring at the stars, as one does. And he's a distinguished man. You know, he'd written a book about navigation. He had drawn up a law code for his own city. He was a thinker. But he was staring at the stars. And in order to get a slightly better view of the constellation he was looking at, he just took a step backwards. And as he stepped backwards, he fell straight into a well, his bottom, into the top of a well. And standing next to the well, probably, you know, getting water or, you know, to do the laundry or whatever, was, this is a story told by Socrates, a girl, so probably like a teenage girl, from Thrace in northern Greece. A beautiful, witty Thracian girl is how Socrates describes her. And as Thales falls into the well, the girl just laughs and laughs and laughs in this beautiful starry night, and says to him, "What is the point of staring at the heavens when you can't even see what there is at your feet?"
It's one of the first great questions. Like, what is philosophy good for?
It's a core question about philosophy. You know, do you really want to attend to the higher things? Shouldn't you really be thinking of kind of material realities down here? You know, what is more important, thinking about the stars or thinking about the laundry? And what is the connection between those two things? And there's a darker aspect to this, which is that Thrace, recognized by all Greeks, is that the name a Thracian is very nearly a synonym for a slave, because the Greeks were slave traders. These cities were all slave trading cities. And there is the implication, not articulated by Socrates, but it's there in the story, that somehow the act of doing philosophy is dependent on there being a Thracian slave to do the laundry. That actually that polarization of things is somehow absolutely intimate with the beginnings of philosophy itself. That philosophy begins as a kind of separating out of the higher things, the staring at the stars, from the ordinary things which you get slaves to do. And slaves, chattel slavery, begins in Greece at exactly the same moment as philosophy begins. And it throws kind of this skeptical doubt all over this kind of otherwise sort of rather excitingly sunny, inventive, adventurous world. I see. So the whole thing is dependent on a slave population. And I think that one cannot deny that aspect of the story, that it's somehow central to it. The philosophy is in some ways rotten for being slave-dependent. It's troubling that. I think it's very troubling.
You address that right at the beginning of the book extensively, and I really appreciated that.
I think not to do so would be completely wrong, because you know it remains a live question, doesn't it?
That's right.
There is a kind of elite culture which kind of thinks about, quote, the higher things the whole time. Very often in our world, dependent on people who do not have access to that culture, for example. And I said this the other day. I was doing a talk about this book, and a woman in the audience, a Greek woman, said, no, you've got this completely wrong. That actually, the kind of really lovely, true, valid life is in that witty, beautiful, laughing Thracian woman who's actually engaged with kind of marvelous realities in the world. And the ridiculous and dispensable figure is Thales. You know, Thales is the fool guy, literally, here, isn't he? You know, and that really you end up thinking, yes, give me material reality, please, and beautiful laughter in a starlit night. I get that.
You write that Socrates said that philosophers will always be a laughingstock. And as you mentioned before,
on that basis, isn't it?
Yeah, and they're the first absent-minded intellectual.
Well, of course, and I think one interesting thing about this pre-Socratic phase, you know, as these philosophers, these are called the philosopher that came before Socrates. I do think that we maybe are now living in a post-Socratic phase. And so if you think most of Western civilization has been really Plato-dominated, that these high and austere and disembodied values, which can fed straight into Christianity, really, have been the kind of governing set of ideas for Western culture. And I think we are now skeptical about them. You know, we don't necessarily think like that anymore. And maybe, in fact, you know, the many 20th century philosophers, Nietzsche and Heidegger and Bergson and the modern French philosophers, have really valued the pre-Socratics for standing outside that rather rigid, high-minded, what we think of maybe as a kind of Victorian now, sort of set of values where the high and the disembodied are what really count. Well, if I think now, many of us, I would include me, think, you know, what's wonderful and what's beautiful about the world is actually material, the actual physical, beautiful world that we're living in and currently trashing, you know. So I think that's maybe why the pre-Socratics are exciting now, because they feel like they have access to some understanding like that, which much of our culture does not.
But Thales tried to get to the root of what everything was, what all of existence is made of. And then there starts the philosophic arguments. He believed that everything, all of existence was water. And then his first follower, Anaximander, he said there was a substance, a Pyrrhon, which was undefined. And he argued against Thales, if all was water, how could fire exist? And then you have Anaximenes, there's the ultimate material is air, and you're sort of off to the races in that sort of philosophical argument that's unknowable.
Yes, I mean, I think the first of all, there's a real connection between this harbor mind and the idea that the essence of things is fluid. You know, all of those, the Thales' water, the apeiron, the undefined, and the idea that everything is air or a breath, they're all essentially fluid. And that feeds on through this tradition in the Greeks that for Heraclitus, their great successor, every physical manifestation is only, you know, everything in the world, every identity in the world is only the place which the wave is now occupying for this instant. That actually the nature, the essential nature of things is this entirely fluid world, and through which the wave moves. And I think that that is also incredibly beautiful and liberating idea, that actually you don't need to attribute any value to the material, because it's all just liquid. And so are we.
Adam, we're completely out of time. And we've just begun.
Oh, no. Yes. Already? We've only just begun.
Well, and there's so much more in the book. We didn't want to give too much away. My guest tonight is award-winning author of books on history, landscape, and great literature, Adam Nicholson. And we've been talking about his latest book. Trust me, this will be more enjoyable than any philosophy book you've read so far. How to Be: Life Lessons from the Early Greeks. Adam, it's been such a pleasure.
And for me too. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.